You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org. Hey, Karthik, how you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you doing, Connor?
I'm good. Why don't I go ahead and introduce us, get them started. I am Connor Eccles. I'm the managing editor of the Non-Zero newsletter, and I am also the host, of course, of this show, Non-Zero World. And I'm very excited to be joined today to talk about all things related to Trump tariffs with Karthik Shankaran, who is I believe you're a senior fellow at the Quincy Institute, senior fellow in like geoeconomics. Is that the what it is?
Yeah.
Perfect.
In the Global South program.
So in the Global South program.
It's several nested titles.
Yeah, beautiful. Nesting doll titles are good. And then I believe you also have a Substack, maybe we should plug at the top, where you write about some issues related to global issues. What's the name of that again?
It's called The Homegrown Globalist, G-R-O-A-N, because I'm notorious for execrable puns. It's kind of mostly in abeyance right now because a lot of my writing I do on for Responsible Statecraft or other media, but it's still live. There's lots of back content actually that is relevant to what we're going to be talking about today, in case people want to check it out.
Well, cool. Well, I'm sure that some of that will come up in this conversation. But anyway, I'm very excited to have you on because obviously this has been a really hectic week in geopolitics, geoeconomics, all kinds of questions around what will these tariffs mean for the future of the U.S., for the future of these foreign countries. You obviously focus on the Global South, so I think that'll be really fruitful. And your background is in part more formal finance as well. So I think that you really understand these issues very deeply. And I do believe that you're not a fan of these tariffs, but I think that the best way for us to start this conversation is for you to sort of give the most positive, affirmative case for these that you can piece together based on your own, kind of sense of it and the Trump administrations. And real quick, before you do that, I'll just lay the groundwork a little. So the main news this week was, of course, Liberation Day, quote unquote. On Wednesday, they imposed a baseline, the Trump administration imposed a baseline 10% tariff on all goods basically from abroad coming into the U.S., and then tariffs up to 50% on other countries based on their own calculations of I guess what they refer to as unfair trade practices. So that's kind of the baseline. But anyway, go ahead and make the argument in favor of this policy.
So the steel man case for tariffs, which asked for essentially that this is their response to a set of practices outside the United States that are deeply unfavorable to the U.S. economy, and particularly to manufacturing workers in the United States, and this means we have to do something about this. The second point is that over the years, what we've seen as a result of globalization is these increasingly interconnected supply chains, which increases U.S. vulnerability to the interruption of these supply chains, as happened during COVID, and the concern is that this might happen in the event of geopolitical conflict. So those are the arguments, one from a national security point of view, and the other from a from the point of view of the domestic economy, to use these tariffs in order to force more production into the United States from where it has gone overseas. There are other arguments also being made that that are not necessarily consistent with the above, but I think it's worth laying out. One is that tariffs are a source of revenue for a government that needs additional sources of revenue. So I think those are the big three. Another one, of course, is that the tariffs, will force a reconsideration in policy outside, in policies outside the United States. It may force countries to make deals that open up their markets, which is something a constituency in the United States wants. Or one result of the tariffs, maybe force changes in economic policy outside the US. So those economies are less reliant on export to the United States. So that's the argument for a rebalancing of supply and demand in the global economy.
Right.
And to varying degrees, I am, you know, I think some of these make sense. It's not clear to me how consistent all these motives are with internally consistent with each other.
Yeah. Yeah. And how does it play into, I mean, it's hard to say exactly what the Trump administration, it's hard to like peek inside the brain of the Trump administration a little bit. There's not necessarily consistency on these sorts of issues, but sort of how does this relate to broader kind of global economic goals for the administration? Because, you know, you've also heard alongside the idea of these tariffs, the possibility of seeking like, you know, devaluing the dollar in order to encourage exports, different policies like that. Like how do you see those there being sort of a coherent set of goals at least in place or sort of ways to get to them?
I think there are two ways to look at this. One is there are certainly goals and currency is a big part of the goal because there is a belief that the dollar is overvalued for a set of reasons that has been structurally overvalued for a very long time. And that is something that needs to change in order to bring about this reindustrialization that people are talking about. As to, you know, and we can go into greater detail into coherence, but I think one way to think about this is also in the context of different factions on trade within the United States. And so what you have to think about is, in my view, is not just what constitutes coherence from the point of view of goals and tools and multiple goals and really only one tool, tariffs in this instance, but also different constituencies in the United States. I've written about this in the past. And I think broadly, there are four factions around trade in the US and I call them openers. Openers are the people who want to use American trade policy or American economic diplomacy in general as a way to force other countries to open their markets to the United States. So if you don't open your markets, we're going to put tariffs on you. And this is the constituency that, you know, kind of a lot of corporate America, agriculture in the United States, some of the finance, some of the sectors of the U.S. economy that are kind of at the leading edge. And of productivity and so on, what they would like to see is the administration, if they're going to use these tariffs, use them as a way to gain concessions from the rest of the world, to lower tariffs, to open their markets and so on. So these are the openers. Another group is what I call decouplers. And those are the people who believe that the single biggest challenge for the US right now is the extent to which the U.S. economy is intertwined with the Chinese economy to the point that it constitutes a national security risk, whether it's in the form of essential imports from imports of essential goods from China or critical technologies being exported to China. So the idea is you kind of pull them apart, which in turn involves finding substitutes for the roles that China plays in the U.S. In the U.S. economy. So the decouplers are the people who say, okay, you know, well, let's take this out of China, put it in Vietnam, put it in India, put it in Mexico.
Right. So they're probably not among the ones who are very happy that we now have a 49% tariff on Vietnam, I'm guessing.
Yeah, exactly. The third group is what I call the repatriationists, who want to bring everything back here. You know,
right.
it's not just enough to take it out of China. What you really want to do is just bring everything back into the US. So roll back globalization, not just as it involves China, which has a clear national security component, but also from the domestic point of view, bring back a large number of the industries that were offshored. And the idea here is, well, if you put the tariffs up, you can, and you want to access the U.S. economy, you just have to build it here.
Right.
And that's something we saw in the 1980s when, you know, when Reagan put tariffs on Japan. There was kind of a lot of diplomatic pressure to that led to the onshoring of the Japanese, a significant portion of the Japanese auto industry that served the U.S. markets over here. So these are the repatriationists. And the last group is what I call the derailers, whose dominant concern, and this is really less about tariffs, play some part in it, but it's essentially the goal is not just to decouple from China, but it's arguably to derail its economic rise. And tariffs can play some part in that, but, you know, export controls, sanctions, secondary export controls, those are the primary tools. Tariffs are a small part of there. So, you know, thinking about these constituencies, thinking about the different outcomes that are desired from tariffs, it's quite a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, well, I'm curious. I mean, I want to come back to China because I think they're interesting both as sort of a target, as a potential beneficiary, and someone who, you know, a country that could suffer from this. But maybe in the short term, I guess, you know, that kind of sets us up well for just like, what's your broad critique of this policy? Like, do you think that this serves the interests of American power in the ways that they view it as serving that? Do you think that it risks leading to a recession, as some people have been saying, you know, those sorts of things?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are, you know, having steel man the case, or at least tried to, I can now get to what some of my concerns are. And you know, I have local concerns in terms of the U.S. economy. And I have global concerns, particularly as it concerns the global South. Right. So the local concerns are pretty straightforward. It's that this is, it will take, even if the reshoring of the U.S. economy does happen as a result of these tariffs, it's going to take quite some time. It takes a long time to build a plant. And in that context, you know, you have to remember that what we're importing from the rest of the world is not just final goods, but also a large number of intermediate goods. And the classic example of this is the auto industry. There's something like 40% of all U.S. auto parts come from outside the U.S. Now, many of these are made in Canada and Mexico, which have their, you know, which have carve outs, but there are still going to be tariffs placed on at least some portion of the intermediate components that come in from outside the U.S. And that means the possibility of pretty large jumps in prices. You had different think tanks put out and kind of industry associations put out estimates of what that means for auto prices. You see numbers from, you know, I think at this point, the average automobile in the U.S., which is the average automobile is more likely an SUV or a light truck, in fact. So, you know, they're more expensive than they used to be. It's probably around $45,000, looking at, you know, 10 to 15% increases in that cost. But beyond that is also the issue that it's not just the tariffs alone that'll make things more expensive. It is the interruptions in supply chains that might cause very serious delays or actually stoppages in production, which then translates into the layoffs over the shorter term. People being placed on furlough has already happened with some plants, just because the supply chains are so interconnected that if something doesn't come through, the assembly line kind of needs to shut down. So that is one set of issues for the U.S. economy. The other point is the extent to which it potentially impacts business investment overall. Because one thing that's not clear, I think, to people is exactly what the end game is here. Are they for negotiation? Are they basically to get other countries to lower their tariffs? So is this kind of being done for the openers in a way the openers might recognize, even if they don't like it? Or is this once and for all, things are going to stay this way? And your decision as a corporation or a corporate board about whether you want to invest, say, $10 billion in putting a plant somewhere in the U.S. to replicate what a plant somewhere outside the U.S. was doing for you is going to depend critically on whether you think this is a done deal or whether it gets undone because it's a negotiating tactic.
That's very interesting. That's very interesting. I wonder, I mean, how does that fit into, you know, if what does it look like if we don't do the negotiating tactic? Like, you know, would you expect there to be a pretty significant sort of rejiggering of international supply chains sort of around the U.S.? Would people just need to kind of bite the bullet a little bit? Like, how do you envision that?
I mean, I certainly think that's the goal. And the argument is, well, if we get there, the U.S. will be more self-sustained in a sense, right? You'll have there's a famous Keynes essay called National Self-Sufficiency that gets people talk about it a lot. And one of the things I like to point out is when Keynes wrote it, he meant imperial self-sufficiency. It was written in 1931, but the U.S. obviously is, it's a vastly larger and more diversified, more sufficient economy than the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland were in 1931. So it makes somewhat more, it might make somewhat more sense in this context, but even so, it would take a considerably longer time, I think. To the extent that one cares about the stock market and the health of corporate America, I mean, I think one important point here is that the U.S. corporate sector is much more international than the overall U.S. economy is. In the sense that imports are, a relatively small portion of U.S. GDP. They are probably, come in at, 3 to 4 trillion. It's about I think the last number is about 14-15%, something like that. But revenues outside the U.S. for the corporate sector are about double that. So that's one of the reasons you're seeing you're seeing the dependence on supply chains and the dependence on revenues from outside the U.S. is one of the reasons you're seeing the kind of reaction you are in the stock markets. So there are fairly large transition costs embedded here for different sections, different groups in the U.S. economy. So that's something to keep in mind. We could get there. It'll take some time. It'll be painful. It'll be more painful for some sectors than for others. From the point of view of the rest of the world, my concern, and particularly the Global South, my concern is that it pulls away a very important ladder that has led to economic growth outside the U.S., and also to what I call more resilient economic growth. Because if you think back to, even just maybe say 50, 60 years ago, what most of what was then called the third world did was produce commodities. And if they had an industrial sector, for instance, it was kind of an import substitution domestic sector. I grew up with Ambassador cars in India that were notorious, you know, that were, I would say, not at the leading edge of technology. And what's happened in the last 30 years has been because of the outward migration of industries from the core of the North Atlantic and Japan. What you've seen is more countries, not across the global south, but certainly in East Asia, Southeast Asia, and now extending into India as well, above all, and also Mexico, a greater integration with global manufacturing supply chains, which has had, in my view, very beneficial effects for those countries. Because what it's done is it has brought in critical investment, it's brought in critical technologies, It's brought in managerial know-how and kind of taken all these things and created a productive sector in those economies that is not just producing for kind of autarkic import substitution reasons like the Ambassador cars that I grew up with, but it's actually building stuff that competes at the frontier mark, you know, at the frontier of the global economy, in the most advanced markets of the global economy.
Right.
And that's been, I think, very good because that knowledge, those technologies have diffused outwards. They've created more modern sectors. And the other thing that it's done is it's given more financial resilience to these countries because having a more diversified export mix, having exports that are less dependent on global commodity prices, you know, all those things have led to greater financial resilience in these countries. And if you think about what we went through, it's kind of a rinse and repeat cycle in global markets that I saw when I was there. You know, commodity exporter invoices things in dollars, borrow in dollars, U.S. economy or global economy turns south, commodity prices crash, they still owe money in dollars, they end up at the IMF. Right. Now things, or at least things were somewhat different over this kind of period where you saw more countries get into habit, into production processes and financial implications thereof that led to more resilience.
Yeah.
But now if you impose these tariffs, you hit those countries, but you're also pulling the ladder away from any other country that tries to do that. And that's my concern.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, it really points to, you know, I guess it's no big surprise to anyone that the Trump administration has somewhat of a zero-sum view of the world. There are winners, there are losers. We want to, you know, Trump wants to be a winner. But it's interesting because when you think of this, you know, I think that the story you're telling about how this has allowed these countries to develop these higher quality industries, there's a feeling in certain parts of the MAGA world that that's being done at the expense of American workers. This is even where you'll get some support from the left on this is the idea that you know, by having other countries be where we're manufacturing even these high tech things, we're giving the advantage to them essentially, and we're lifting them up. And in some ways, they would argue, I guess, that's not helping us. I don't know if that's really my view, but you can kind of see how they start to form.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I totally understand that point of view. And you know, one of the reasons, one of the responses has been that in certain trade agreements, you have had mechanisms, and the most obvious example of this is USMCA. Where you have certain mechanisms to, you know, to ensure that some of the most problematic practices associated with this kind of thing, it's the so-called rapid response mechanism that's embedded in USMCA, which is where firms that do not comply with certain rules are excluded from the benefits of USMCA. So if you don't allow a union to form, right. then that's reported, and if there's a finding, and this kind of removes the the concern that the Mexican government would not allow it. Essentially, what it does is it creates a mechanism where the arbiter is independent of the Mexican government and can say, okay, you are not following the rules that we set forth. So your factory or your establishment is excluded from the benefits of USMCA. So, and there have been arguments made by people kind of on the broad anti-globalization left that this is good. We should be extending it. We should be extending it further outward. Another point I would make is that, you know, you've had, and this is kind of where you have differences across industries. So, and that's hard. These are difficult choices because one of the things that happens when countries get richer through these mechanisms is that they might hurt labor in those industries that are most exposed to technological catch-up, but increase the markets for those that potentially benefit from wealthier consumers outside the U.S.
Right.
So in this instance, you know, it's the worker at Boeing, for example, versus the Boeing at an auto parts manufacturer. And, you know, one of the ways to think about this is, what does this country, or what will this country start making that is potentially a threat to labor in the United States as this process unfolds? And what will a worker in this country be able to buy as a result of these processes, which might help someone else in either a different factory or an American farmer? You know, so there's no question that these are trade-offs, and they need to be managed, and they have been managed not very well. I think that's how I would frame it. So I certainly understand where this is coming from. I think one final point I would make here is that there's a series of things that have happened in American industry, really over the last 40 years, that are not necessarily the result of globalization per se. They are the result of a set of transformations within American capitalism starting in the mid-1980s that may also have contributed to some of these things. You know, the leverage buyout wave of the 1980s, for instance, the role of kind of the broad role of private equity. I mean, essentially, if you think about a set of financial operations that are gained to maximize financial returns from industrial plant, it may lead you in directions that are potentially more short term, that are potentially more harmful to labor, that are potentially militate against longer term investment in ways that are entirely independent of the impact of trade. So I would suggest there's a domestic component there as well in some of these concerns.
Yeah. That's such a tough one for the Trump people to kind of bring in, because I think that there's a real desire for that sort of, it's a strong narrative, right? Is that there's the enemy abroad, that they're screwing us, and, you know, we've done everything right, but we got to put up these tariffs so that we, you know, it just sounds good, right? It's a straightforward political narrative, but in many ways, obviously flattens what the actual economy looks like.
I'm hardly ever on Facebook, but, you know, what's the relationship status? It's complicated. That's what I like to say about a lot of things. It's complicated. It depends. You know, that's
like
one of my go-to phrases.
yeah. No, exactly. So, and I should note, you talked a little bit about the USMCA and the way that was, of course, negotiated by Trump, and that incorporated some of these labor protections, some of these minimum wage floors. We had a piece that discussed that more in the Non-Zero newsletter yesterday by our editor-in-chief, Robert Wright. So I encourage listeners to go check that out. But let's move off of that a little bit and zero in a little bit more on sort of, I think Asia is probably the most interesting, especially East and South Asia are probably the most interesting area in terms of what the tariffs will mean, especially if they stay in place. I don't know if we want to start with China first or the other countries in the region first, but it's very notable that all these countries that have been, like you said, Vietnam, these different, especially Southeast Asian countries that have been sort of the new places exporting to the U.S. in the wake of the U.S. not wanting to deal as much with China, they're getting hit by some of these biggest tariffs, and that must be creating quite a reaction from those governments and kind of a scramble.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, particularly in Vietnam. I mean, if you look at the countries that are most exposed to imports from the U.S. as a portion of their economies, the big three are Canada and Mexico, which makes sense, and Vietnam. And in some ways, this was always kind of expected. I remember back when TPP was still a thing, you know, this in 2015 or so, there were all these studies commissioned about which country would benefit the most from TPP, which essentially was an Obama-era attempt to do decoupling, because it was going to be a trade agreement that had China out and brought all these substitutes in. And the most obvious one was Vietnam, which has essentially replaced, or to a substantial degree, what we've seen in Vietnam is a replacement of China. And my view is that, my somewhat cynical view has been that it's because it looked like China did in the 1990s, in the sense that its political system, looks like China, but it's not China. And several of the concerns expressed about China don't apply to Vietnam, in the sense that, you know, concerns about IP theft being a national security issue, for instance, they would not apply to Vietnam to quite the same degree, precisely because they're kind of further behind the technological curve and they're not a competitor. But, so Vietnam was supposed to be one of the big winners of decoupling, and that happened with TPP and it happened subsequently. So right now, what this has done is it creates a real dilemma for them. It's one of these places where the problem, I think, is probably going to be more acute than in other countries that are less exposed. I saw there was Adam Tooze had something talking about Vietnam has maybe more than 100,000 workers employed in Nike factories.
Oh, well.
Because the offshore, those are places where there's going to be that's a place where there's going to be a very substantial impact. As you go further away, the impact potentially becomes more diluted, and just in the sense that the exports to the U.S. as a share of GDP are not as big. It's still going to have impacts. And the ultimate question then comes: who can substitute? Kind of at a global level, the question of who can substitute for U.S. consumer demand in the global economy is kind of the meta question that we're asking at this point. I think it's big, but not necessarily insurmountable. And I can go into the numbers about how I think about this. But for some countries, those that are particularly exposed to American final demand, it's a big issue. And the big, you know, the big three are Canada, Mexico, and Vietnam.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe that brings us to the conversation about, to a broader conversation about where China fits into all of this, because, you know, I've seen the argument that, you know, a potential Chinese response to these tariffs could be to sort of rejigger their economy somewhat in order to stimulate domestic demand for like imported goods from abroad, would maybe create some of that demand that you're describing. Do you see that as a plausible thing, or what do you think about that?
China's just an enormous economy, and one of the goals that's been laid out, and this was set forth by Scott Bessent, is one of the purposes of the tariffs is to force other countries to change their economic structures. And and he specifically singled out China and said what he wanted to do was have that country rely more on domestic consumption than on exports as a driver of its economy. And the hard thing here is we're used to thinking about this in terms of broad macroeconomic aggregates, right? So how easy is it to replace 1% of GDP that does this with 1% of GDP that does that? Right. And you come up with a set of answers that go, okay, they just need to do this. It does not, which I think is feasible, right? My view is that if you get more Chinese support for consumption, and in the context of China, also less need for its citizens to believe they need to have a higher level of precautionary savings, that they need to save so much, you potentially end up in a place where you could do that. You could do that one-for-one transfer. There are enormous costs along the way, of course, because it's no different from this argument that I was making previously about, if you have 300,000 workers in auto plants in the upper Midwest are hurt by this, that 150,000 workers in Boeing plants, 150,000 farmers who will do better. That's a very broad abstraction. It's not necessarily, which you can kind of do from a 30,000 foot view as an economist who's not experiencing either of those things. Right. And you will potentially have the same issue, in the Chinese case, and certainly in the Vietnamese case. So, there are enormous transition costs everywhere, but in some places these transition costs will be so large as to potentially be very, very difficult to swallow, depending on the capacity of the governments to execute, depending on things like, are people mobile?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that kind of points us to maybe the biggest question of all of this is, or from sort of the DC perspective that you usually hear is, what does this mean for China? Is this, some people are sort of calling it a victory for them. It opens up these opportunities to deepen economic links with other countries in its region. It makes it look like a more stable partner than the US does. And then at the same time, obviously, it poses all sorts of challenges, both in the transition, like you've described, and just for the fact that China does send a lot of stuff to the US and this will directly impact its economy this year. Like, how do you think, either from the perspective of Chinese leadership or just from sort of a macro perspective of like the ideal situation for Chinese power, like how do you think this will work out for them?
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.